Imagine an industrial machine. It is highly engineered, relies on these finely tuned algorithms, and it's designed from the ground up for one specific purpose.
Right, predictable behavioral conversion.
Exactly. You feed it a person's attention, and it reliably produces a calculated neurochemical result.
It's pure science at that point.
Yeah. But now, imagine that this machine doesn't look like a server rack or, an engine block. It looks exactly like a paperback romance novel sitting on your nightstand.
Or an app on your phone.
Right, or a pair of headphones playing a sultry voice. Welcome to today's deep dive. We are so glad you are here with us.
It really is the ultimate camouflage, isn't it? We are talking about a multi-billion dollar industry that most people just categorize as, well, guilty pleasure reading.
Yeah, casual entertainment, just a fun beach read.
Exactly. But when you look at the research analyzing modern explicit romance and erotica fiction, you see something entirely different. You see a highly optimized delivery system.
And that is our mission today. We have this massive stack of clinical data, neurobiological research, and sociological studies.
It is a staggering amount of data,
Just,
honestly.
it really is. And the sources break this genre down into six distinct engines. We're going to unpack exactly how this invisible machinery engineers attention, belief, and desire.
And we really want to stress our goal here isn't to judge the genre or the people who read it.
No, not at all. We just want to understand the incredible science of how it rewires the brain, basically one irresistible book at a time.
It's fascinating stuff.
Okay, let's unpack this. Let's start with the first piece of the puzzle, which the sources call the immersion engine.
This is where the foundation is built.
Yeah, and the core concept here completely flipped how I usually think about reading. Typically, when you pick up like a thriller or a mystery, the plot is the point.
Right. You want to know who the killer is?
Exactly. But in this genre, the structure is inverted. The plot actually isn't the point at all.
No. The industry actually refers to the plot as scaffolding.
Scaff?
Yeah. Major author services authorities like Jericho Writers and professional writers like Christian Baines, they openly state this.
These are people whose literal job is to optimize these books for the market, right?
Exactly. They state that in explicit romance, the plot revolves around the physical intimacy, not the other way around.
The word scaffolding is just perfect to me. I mean, scaffolding is just the temporary metal poles you put up to support the actual building.
It is not the building itself.
Right. But what is it supporting in this case?
It is essentially a timing device for reward. Professional craft guides explicitly warn authors against jumping straight into the physical act.
Oh, interesting. So they are told to hold back.
Yes, the instruction is to build tension through, lingering glances, near misses, interruptions, forced proximity.
Ah, forced proximity. Like, oh no, there was only one bed in the hotel.
Exactly that trope. The scaffolding's entire function is to manufacture the chase and purposefully delay the payout.
It is a slot machine. If you think about how a slot machine works, right? If you sit down, pull the lever, and the machine instantly spits out a $20 bill, there is no thrill.
The thrill is the spinning of the wheels.
Yes. The spinning is the point. The machine is purposefully delaying the payout to maximize the rush when the cherries finally line up.
What is fascinating here is the underlying neurobiology. To understand why that slot machine mechanic is so devastatingly effective, we have to look at dopamine.
The pleasure chemical, right?
Well, that is the common misconception. The pioneering research by neuroscientist Wolfram Schultz in the late 90s fundamentally changed our understanding of reward.
Okay, how so? What did he do?
He was studying macaques, measuring their brain activity when they were given a drop of sweet juice.
Just giving monkeys juice. Sounds like a good gig.
Right. So initially, the dopamine neurons fired when the monkey actually tasted the juice.
Which makes intuitive sense. You get a reward, you feel good.
Exactly. But then Schultz introduced a cue. He flashed a light right before delivering the juice.
Like Pavlov's bell.
Very similar, yes. After a while, the dopamine spike shifted. It stopped firing when the monkey got the juice and started firing the moment the light flashed.
Wait, really? It stopped firing for the actual juice.
Yes. Because dopamine isn't the chemical of pleasure or liking the reward, it is the chemical of wanting.
Oh, wow.
It fires for the prediction of the reward, not the receipt of it.
That distinction is wild. The chemical reward in your brain is literally paid out for the chase, not the catch.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So a genre optimized for anticipation is optimized for wanting. The plot stretches out the cues.
The brush of a hand, the intense stare across a room.
Right. Your dopamine system is firing heavily during that entire delay. and wanting is the exact neural state that sustains a compulsive, hours-long pursuit.
That makes so much sense. But the engine goes further than just pacing the plot, doesn't it? It fundamentally changes who is experiencing that anticipation.
Yes, it changes the perspective entirely.
The sources detail how the industry relies heavily on first-person voice and this concept of the blank slate protagonist.
Think of characters like Bella Swan or Anastasia Steele. They are purposefully underdescribed.
They are essentially empty vessels.
They are engineered sockets, sized perfectly for the reader to step into. When the text uses the grammatical eye, and the character has very few defining traits of her own, it collapses the distance.
The distance between the reader and the protagonist just vanishes.
Exactly. In fan fiction, this is taken to the logical extreme with the YN or your name convention.
Oh, I have seen that, where it literally tells the reader to insert their own name into the text.
Yes. It explicitly invites the reader to occupy the space.
I have seen readers say, you know, when I read first person, that is me in the book. But how does the brain actually process that level of immersion? It can't just be an overactive imagination, right?
No. It is rooted in how the medial prefrontal cortex operates.
The medial prefrontal cortex. Okay, what does that do?
It is a region of the brain involved in social navigation and self-representation. Research into social surrogacy shows that, especially for individuals experiencing loneliness, the brain blurs the boundary.
The boundary between real and fictional people.
Yes. The medial prefrontal cortex doesn't rigidly compartmentalize these characters into a fake folder. It files them under people.
That is incredible. So it creates a measurable parasocial bond. Your brain is processing this fictional character as a genuine relationship.
A highly specific type of relationship, actually. This character functions as a secure base.
A secure base, meaning what exactly?
Meaning someone who is always available, perfectly predictable, and structurally incapable of rejecting the reader.
Because they are a book. They literally can't leave you.
Right. And when you experience intimacy from that secure base, the brain releases oxytocin, the attachment hormone.
Let me put these pieces together because this is clicking for me now. You have the spinning slot machine of the plot dripping dopamine through constant anticipation.
Right.
And then you have this intimate first-person bond triggering an oxytocin release. It is a dual neurochemical loop.
Yes, dopamine and oxytocin. Wanting and attachment firing simultaneously.
That combination sounds incredibly potent and, frankly, probably pretty rare to experience at that sustained frequency in ordinary life.
It is rare, but this isn't just an accidental byproduct of a good storyteller. It is an industrialized business model.
Right. The industry knows exactly what it is doing.
We see major publishers like Atria and Entangled Publishing acquiring manuscripts based entirely on a checklist of pre-sold reward triggers.
You mean tropes, right? Like enemies to lovers or the billionaire boss?
Exactly. They are building the scaffolding around the dopamine spikes before the book is even written. They acquire based on the trope.
And the most aggressive evolution of this has to be the serialized apps. Yeah. Platforms like Galatea or Radish, have you looked at those?
Yes, they strip away the traditional book format entirely.
They serve the story in tiny, fractionalized chapters directly on your phone.
Those platforms expose the timing logic in its purest, most clinical form. They employ what we call a cliffhanger unlock loop.
Oh, I hate those, but they work so well.
The plot stretches the anticipation until the dopamine prediction is at its absolute peak. The characters are finally alone in a room. The tension is unbearable.
And then the app just locks you out. The screen stops. You hit a paywall.
Exactly. You either have to wait 6 hours to unlock the next chapter, or you pay a fractionalized amount, like coins or tokens, to bypass the wait.
They are literally turning the physiological delay of arousal into a financial transaction. You are swiping your credit card to complete your own dopamine loop.
It is brilliant from a business perspective and terrifyingly effective.
Yeah, it really is.
It also induces the behavioral signature of tolerance. Chronic exposure to high-frequency, variable rewards downregulates the brain's dopamine receptors.
Wait, downregulates? So the baseline shifts?
Yes. Over time, the reader requires more extreme tropes, higher stakes, or more frequent reading sessions just to reach the level of neurochemical reward the loop once delivered freely.
So they are building an escalating tolerance, just like with a substance.
Precisely.
Okay, so that is the printed page and the phone screen. But the industry found a way to bypass the imagination entirely.
They found a way to inject this neurochemical loop straight into the listener's nervous system.
Which brings us to the second engine, the voice in your ear. The sources dive into this booming world of audiobooks and audio erotica.
Platforms like Dipsy and Quinn are leading this charge.
And audio formats, they don't change the immersion engine we just talked about, right? They just act as an amplifier.
They turn the volume all the way up. The printed page requires a cognitive middleman. You have to look at abstract symbols, decode them into language, and mentally simulate a voice.
Right, you are doing the work of creating the scene in your head.
But audio bypasses that translation process completely.
The psychological phenomenon the sources highlight here is called in-head localization. I found this part so interesting.
It really changes how we interact with media.
When you listen to a podcast or an audiobook on speakers across the room, the sound exists in the physical space with you, but headphones change that.
Yes, when you wear headphones, it creates an acoustic illusion.
The speaker sounds like they are originating from inside your own skull. It is a distance reserved only for intimate whispering.
The brain is highly attuned to spatial acoustics. Multiple experiments with thousands of participants demonstrate this clearly.
What do the experiments show?
That listeners on headphones perceive the communicator as physically and socially closer. They find them more persuasive and warmer than when listening through external speakers.
Because the acoustic signature of headphone audio mimics the physical proximity of someone right next to you.
Exactly.
But wait, hold on. I want to bring up the study from University College London because it completely broke my brain.
The audio versus video study.
Yeah. They took 100 participants and had them either watch a fully rendered, highly engaging video scene or just listen to the audio of that exact same scene.
And they measured their physiological reactions.
Right. Heart rate, skin conductance, body temperature. And the reaction was significantly stronger for the audio listeners.
It is a biological paradox.
But the listeners actually reported feeling less engaged than the video watchers. Why would hearing a voice trigger a stronger physical reaction than seeing a fully rendered video? It makes no logical sense.
It comes down to evolutionary biology and how the brain allocates processing power.
Okay, break that down for me.
Watching a video requires massive cognitive resources from the visual cortex. You are tracking movement, analyzing background details, processing lighting.
Your brain is busy rendering the visual data.
Exactly. Audio removes that visual load, allowing the brain to focus entirely on the emotional signal.
That makes sense, but why is the emotional signal from audio so physically powerful?
Furthermore, we possess dedicated networks in the superior temporal cortex known as temporal voice areas.
Temporal voice areas, so parts of the brain just for voices.
Yes. The brain evolved to treat a human voice as a privileged social signal. A printed page doesn't have a direct line to your reward system, but a human voice does. Hearing a breathy whisper in the dark triggered our ancestors' survival instincts. It meant someone was right there, within touching distance.
So it is literally a direct backdoor to the nervous system.
It transmits what we call emotional prosody. The breathiness, the catch in the throat, the subtle rhythm of speech.
You don't have to imagine the emotion because the voice transmits it directly.
Yes, through vocal contagion. To put this in perspective, research demonstrates that hearing a mother's voice on the phone can raise oxytocin levels in stressed children.
To the same degree as a physical hug, right?
To the exact same degree. The molecule of human attachment is releasable by the human voice alone.
The voice is doing all the heavy lifting for your oxytocin, and the industry is monetizing this through techniques like duet narration.
Duet narration is incredibly popular right now.
For those who don't know, this is where two voice actors perform the dialogue in real time, together in the booth.
They're capturing organic reactions, actual breathing. A printed sex scene cannot breathe. A performed one does.
And this creates a totally new kind of parasocial dynamic. The book boyfriend, or idealized protagonist, is no longer just a concept on a page.
They are a real living voice. Listeners bond so deeply with these specific performances.
The sources say listeners actually track down the voice actor's pseudonyms to follow them.
Yes, they will follow a specific voice across entirely different authors and genres, seeking out that specific acoustic trigger on demand.
You form a parasocial bond with a real-world target who is speaking directly into the center of your brain. That is intense.
It is. Now think about the state the listener is in at this point.
Right. You have a massive dopamine-oxytocin cocktail flooding your system. Your physical defenses are completely lowered.
You are socially bonded to a voice inside your head. That leaves the brain's critical thinking centers totally unguarded.
Which naturally invites a massive shift in how you view the world. If you are in that highly suggestible state for hours a week, what happens to your real-world beliefs?
This brings us to the third engine, the persuasion engine. How explicit fiction rewrites belief.
Okay, let's unpack this. If I read an op-ed in a newspaper, my brain automatically puts its guard upright. I am looking for flaws in the argument.
That is normal critical thinking.
But the sources talk about the science of narrative transportation. When you are absorbed in a story, that critical guard simply drops.
The psychological term is the suppression of counter-arguing.
Suppression of counter-arguing, okay.
When you are transported by a narrative, especially one driving intense neurochemical reward, your default cognitive state shifts.
It shifts from skepticism to acceptance.
Exactly. You absorb the events in the story not as arguments to be debated, but as lived experiences to be cataloged.
And the scariest part of this is that you can learn false facts from fiction and you will actually resist correcting them later.
The absolute sleeper effect. It is a fascinating glitch in human memory.
Please explain the absolute sleeper effect because it sounds completely backwards.
Normally, you expect the persuasive impact of a message to fade over time, right?
Yeah, you hear an ad, and a week later, you don't really care anymore.
But with the absolute sleeper effect, the persuasive impact of something you read in a fiction book actually increases over time.
Increases. How does the brain decouple a piece of information from the fact that it was literally made up in a novel?
It relies on the difference between semantic memory and episodic memory.
Okay, semantic versus episodic.
Semantic memory is your storage for facts, knowing that Paris is the capital of France. Episodic memory is your storage for the context of how you learned those facts.
So remembering the specific fourth grade classroom where I learned about Paris.
Exactly. And the key here is that episodic memory decays much faster than semantic memory.
Oh, I see where this is going.
So you read a compelling piece of information in a novel. Weeks later, the episodic tag, the memory of, I learned this in a fiction book, decays and falls off.
But the semantic tag, the fact itself, remains?
Yes. It undergoes source dissociation. Mm-hmm. You forget where you heard it, so your brain just assumes it is a true piece of background knowledge.
Combine that absolute sleeper effect with the sheer volume of consumption in this genre. We are talking about highly dedicated readers finishing 3, 4, 5 novels a week.
The sources refer to this as the cultivation effect.
Cultivation effect. So heavy consumers slowly adopt the background worldview of the stories as their own baseline for what is normal.
And the worldview of modern romance and erotica is incredibly pluralistic.
Yes. The sources show it features vast, sympathetic representations of queer romance, polyamory, kink, consensual non-monogamy.
Think about a reader who lives in a highly conservative, maybe homogenous area. They might not know anyone in those marginalized communities in real life.
But their e-reader is supplying them with hundreds of hours of first-person intimate contact with these lifestyles.
The sociological framework for this is the parasocial contact hypothesis.
Right, because we've known for decades that real-world intergroup contact reduces prejudice. If you spend time with people different from you, your biases decrease.
The breakthrough in media psychology is the realization that parasocial contact bonding with a fictional character functions as a powerful substitute.
A substitute for real-world contact, and it measurably reduces prejudice and shifts public opinion.
Yes, it is highly effective.
Here is where it gets really interesting to me. The cultural implications of this are massive. We've witnessed historic national shifts in attitudes toward LGBTQ+ rights and consensual non-monogamy over the last 2 decades.
Massive media consumption of these sympathetic tropes acts as a silent, powerful mainstreaming instrument.
But I have to push back here. Let me play devil's advocate for a second.
Go for it.
When I look at this, my first thought is self-selection. A deeply conservative, traditional person isn't going to accidentally buy a reverse harem polyamory novel.
That is a fair point.
Permissive people choose to read permissive books, right? Wait, isn't this just an echo chamber reflecting what readers already believe?
That is the most common intuitive objection. But the empirical data dismantles it entirely.
Really?
The sources cite a pivotal national panel study by researchers Wright and Bay.
Okay, a panel study.
A panel study surveys the exact same group of people at multiple points in time, often years apart. This allows researchers to track the causal arrow.
Ah, so they can see what came first, the chicken or the egg.
Exactly. They measured the participants' sexual media consumption and their real-world attitudes at wave one, and then measured both again at wave 2 years later.
And what did they find?
The study proved that media consumption at wave one successfully predicted a shift toward more permissive attitudes at wave two.
Okay, but did their prior attitudes predict what they read?
No. Prior permissive attitudes at wave one did not predict an increase in media consumption. The reading caused the attitude change. The attitude did not cause the reading.
Wow. The causal arrow goes strictly from the book to the belief.
Yes, it functions as a reinforcing spiral. A mild curiosity or the appeal of a specific trope pulls a reader in.
Just dipping a toe in.
Right. And the immersion in the book shifts their attitude slightly further than they would have moved on their own.
And then that new, slightly shifted attitude makes them comfortable pulling a slightly more extreme book off the shelf.
Which shifts them further still. It compounds over years.
If this machinery can rewrite public political beliefs about society on a macro level, it has to be doing something even more profound to the reader's private personal desires.
Which brings us to the fourth engine, the script engine, authoring private desire.
Authoring desire. I love that phrasing.
The foundational premise here comes from sociologists Gagnon and Simon. They proposed that human sexual desire is not an innate, hardwired instinct.
It is a learned script, right?
Exactly. Just like you aren't born knowing how to order food at a restaurant, you learn the script of sitting down, looking at a menu, speaking to a waiter. You aren't born with a specific map of sexual desire.
The sources focus on what they call the intrapsychic script. What is that?
The intrapsychic script is the deepest, most private level of sexual scripting. It is the internal ordering of images, scenarios, and power dynamics that elicit and sustain sexual arousal in an individual.
It is basically the operating system for your arousal, and culture installs it.
Yes, and this is where the reader's background becomes incredibly important.
Right. Many readers, particularly women raised in restrictive, highly religious environments or purity culture, are taught from a young age to suppress any thought about sex.
They are instilled with erotophobia, a deep-seated sex guilt.
They are never allowed to explore their desires. So they reach adulthood with a blank hard drive, essentially. They literally do not know what arouses them.
Purity culture produces a vacuum of sexual self-knowledge, and into that vacuum steps the explicit romance genre.
It offers a private, low-risk laboratory to explore arousal.
But media script theory suggests the genre isn't just helping them uncover pre-existing dormant desires. It is actively authoring the blueprint for them from scratch.
Because they are reading hundreds of these books, they are exposed to hundreds of fictional partners, but the human brain can't keep 100 different episodic memories of distinct heroes clear.
No, the sources detail a cognitive process called the prototype merge.
The prototype merge, like blending them all together.
Exactly. Neural networking in the brain loves efficiency. If you show a computer 100 faces and ask it to find the commonalities, it will average them out into one composite face.
And the human brain does the same thing with personality traits and behavioral dynamics in these books.
Repeated exposure causes the brain to abstract the central tendencies of all these fictional heroes into a single prototype.
So you forget the specific eye color or the dialogue of a character from 3 years ago.
Instead, your brain merges all the possessive billionaires, all the fiercely loyal fated mates, into one single composite ideal.
And because this composite ideal is constantly present in the reader's mind during hundreds of hours of conditioned sexual arousal, the brain wires them together.
It's classical conditioning. The composite ideal becomes the trigger for the intrapsychic script.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, this creates a real problem, doesn't it?
It creates what psychologists call the tragedy of the unmet sexual ideal.
Because this composite hero is a supernormal stimulus.
He is an amalgamation of perfection. Perfectly devoted, endlessly wealthy, fiercely protective, perfectly attuned to physical needs.
And fundamentally, structurally incapable of ever rejecting her or getting tired.
It is an impossible standard.
It is like building a Frankenstein's monster of perfect relationship traits stitched together from 100 different novels and then getting frustrated that your real-life spouse doesn't match the blueprint.
A real human partner is finite, flawed, gets stressed at work, has their own needs. They can never compete with a supernormal stimulus.
And on top of that, we see the emergence of the barrier of shame.
Yes, because the scripts the genre installs often involve intense taboo elements or kink.
The data indicates that roughly a third of people have never shared their favorite or most frequent fantasy with their real-world partner.
They drastically overestimate the likelihood of judgment or rejection.
So they keep the script a total secret. They possess this hyper-specific, perfectly tuned blueprint of desire that was literally written by a commercial algorithm, and they never tell their partner about it.
Which structurally ensures that the script has nowhere to be enacted except back inside the fiction.
The reader must return to the book because the book is the only theater where their desire is allowed to run free.
The secret keeps them reading, and the reading deepens the script. It is a closed loop.
The statistics really back this up. A majority of romance readers admit the genre makes them significantly more selective and critical of real-world partners.
The impact on real-world relationships is measurable.
But if this genre is literally authoring the blueprint of what millions of readers secretly desire, we have to look objectively at what is actually in that blueprint.
We do. And we have to approach this next part very objectively, looking strictly at the clinical findings.
Right. According to the data, the core of the genre isn't just passion or romance. Which brings us to the fifth engine, the coercion engine.
Across a 181-novel corpus analyzed in the sources, the center of gravity in the genre is power and coercion.
Dominance and submission are the default settings, right?
Yes. Mafia themes, literal captivity, and intense possessive language, like you belong to me, are pervasive across the bestseller lists.
The sources outline how negotiated withdrawable consent is actually the statistical minority case in these texts.
The genre systematically takes the diagnostic criteria for intimate partner abuse and reassigns them as marks of a love that is simply too intense to be contained.
Okay, what kind of clinical comparisons are we talking about here?
A systematic, peer-reviewed analysis of 50 Shades of Grey matched the relationship dynamics of the protagonists directly against the CDC definitions of intimate partner violence.
And what did they find?
The researchers found pervasive emotional abuse, stalking, and isolation. The male protagonist dictates what the heroine eats, who she speaks to, and where she goes.
Yet the narrative framework of the book frames all of this as romance and care.
Similarly, an analysis of the Twilight series found that behaviors like watching the heroine sleep in her bedroom without her knowledge or tracking her movements across town were reframed.
Reframed for a massive young adult audience as ultimate protection and devotion. This is where I struggle. Why does this appeal to millions of readers? How does a reader reconcile undeniably coercive, dark themes with the concept of aspirational romance?
The sources explain this mechanism through the control paradox.
The control paradox, okay.
The appeal of a dark, coercive scenario in fiction is that the reader holds total absolute control over a scenario about losing control.
Ah, because they are reading a book.
Exactly. Women's force fantasies are actually quite common in the psychological literature, and they are psychologically safe, precisely because they are entirely authored and bounded by the fantasizer.
The reader can literally just close the book at any time.
The data shows this preference correlates with high sexual openness, not with trauma or pathology.
Okay, so the fantasy itself isn't a secret wish for real-world harm. It is a safe, bounded sandbox to experience a taboo thrill.
Correct. However, the machine doesn't just match a baseline predisposition. It amplifies and normalizes it.
It conditions arousal to violence and non-consent through repeated exposure.
Yes. And to make this palatable, the genre employs a very specific persuasion device to dress the coercion up so the reader's moral defense is accepted.
Dressing it in the language of biology and fate. Tropes like the fated mate or the alpha instinct.
Those tropes are everywhere in fantasy romance right now.
The narrative explicitly tells the reader he can't help it. It's his instinct. You were biologically made for him.
And that completely dissolves the question of consent. It neutralizes the alarm bells that would normally go off in the brain's threat detection system.
Because it is framed as destiny, not coercive control.
We also see the reframing of grooming as courtship.
Yeah, the sources note a recurrent, highly popular plot structure involving massive power asymmetry and age deferral.
A guardian, a mentor, or an immortal being watches over a much younger heroine.
Building a profound emotional and psychological dependency over years, but strictly waiting until her exact 18th birthday for physical contact.
Clinical literature maps this progression directly onto the characterized stages of adult sexual grooming. Targeting, gaining trust, feeling a need, and isolating.
But the fiction narrates this process from the groomer's point of view and scores the psychological capture as an epic patient love story.
And the really chilling part is the cultural migration of this script. The worldview bleeds out of the sandbox.
The sources note that younger demographics are increasingly viewing partner location tracking on their cell phones not as an invasion of privacy, but as a standard sign of care.
The genre has spent decades coding the watched, monitored, isolated heroine as the most loved woman in the world.
And that reading translates into real-world reality. It trains an intrapsychic script where the marks of being controlled are automatically decoded by the brain as the marks of being loved.
It is a profound psychological shift.
Let's summarize the journey of our hypothetical reader so far. She is hooked by the dopamine loop of the plot scaffolding.
Her physical defenses are lowered by the parasocial bond and the acoustic illusion of a voice in her ear.
Her public political beliefs are slowly shifted toward permissiveness by the absolute sleeper effect. Her private desires are morphed into an impossible composite ideal.
And she is conditioned to view extreme control and surveillance as expressions of devotion.
So what happens when she realizes this? Say she wakes up one day, realizes this is negatively impacting her real-world marriage, and decides to quit.
She decides to delete the apps, throw away the books, and just walk away.
Does her brain just go back to normal?
That is the subject of the final piece of the puzzle, the persistence engine, the trap.
The intuitive assumption is that if you stop reading, the effects will gradually fade away.
But the science of extinction proves that assumption is entirely wrong.
The science of extinction. Stopping a learned behavior does not erase the learning.
In behavioral psychology, extinction is not unlearning. When a conditioned behavior is no longer rewarded, when you stop reading the books, the original neural association isn't deleted.
It is still on the hard drive.
Yes. Instead, the brain installs a fragile, context-dependent layer of inhibition over it. The original association survives completely intact underneath.
I like to think of it like muting a tab on your web browser.
That's a perfect analogy.
You haven't closed the video. The video is still playing, the audio is still running, it is still consuming memory and bandwidth. You just installed a temporary piece of code that stops the sound from reaching your speakers.
And the moment you right-click and unmute it, the sound is instantly blasting again at full volume.
So let's look at how this muted tab applies to the layers we've discussed. First, the parasocial bond.
Neurological bonds do not dissolve, they go dormant. The sources cite longitudinal studies on television finale grief.
Like the intense grief reported after the finale of the show, Friends.
Exactly. Losing a parasocial bond triggers the exact same neural pathways as the grief of a real-life breakup.
But the bond isn't dead. If you hear that character's voice again 5 years later, it instantly reactivates. You don't have to rebuild the relationship from scratch.
You just unmuted the tab. Second, the beliefs and attitudes. We discussed the absolute sleeper effect earlier.
Right, where the source of the fact decays, but the belief remains.
Attitudes changed by narrative transportation actually harden into what psychologists call chronically accessible defaults.
Chronically accessible defaults?
Because the episodic memory decays over time, the belief can actually grow stronger and more rigid during a period of abstinence.
So the fictional worldview becomes the permanent lens you see reality through. You can't just unsee it.
Third, the intrapsychic script. The sexual template that was authored by the prototype merge has consolidated into a default cognitive schema.
It is woven into how the brain perceives attraction, and that schema outlasts any specific memory of the books.
And finally, the craving itself. What happens to the neurochemistry of the reader who tries to quit?
Yeah, do they get withdrawals?
They face the incubation of craving. Just like with withdrawal from highly palatable foods or chemical substances, the cue-induced seeking doesn't disappear on day one.
It actually climbs, right?
The craving intensifies steadily, usually be peaking around 2 months after quitting.
Wait, really? 60 days after you stop reading? Your physical craving for the genre is actually worse than it was on day one?
Yes, because the physical traces of reward conditioning persist in the brain's architecture. The sources specifically point to the accumulation of a protein called delta-FOSB.
Delta-FOSB, what exactly does that do?
It acts as a molecular switch for compulsive reward seeking. Every time you spike your dopamine with one of these intense variable reward reading sessions, a little bit of delta FOSB is produced.
Produced in the reward circuitry of your brain, right?
Specifically the nucleus accumbens. Unlike other proteins that degrade quickly, delta FOSB is highly stable. It builds up like a heavy metal with repeated stimulation.
And what does it do once it builds up?
It is a transcription factor. It literally alters how your genes are expressed in the reward center, structuralizing the addiction.
It alters gene expression. That is terrifying.
And because it degrades so incredibly slowly, it persists in the brain for months after you stop the behavior.
So the sensitized wanting, that massive dopamine production error we talked about at the beginning, can persist for years.
Completely independent of whether the person even consciously wants to engage with the books anymore.
It is an incredibly asymmetrical machine. Think about how easy it is to enter. You download an app on your phone, you put in your headphones.
You get an immediate rush of dopamine and oxytocin. The parasocial bond forms in a matter of hours.
The worldview is absorbed without any critical resistance, but it is brutally, fundamentally hard to leave.
The engine is built to be entered effortlessly, but it is not built to be left. Quitting just puts a thin layer of inhibition over a permanently altered neural landscape.
And that is the full architecture of the explicit romance genre, from the plot scaffolding that engineers the dopamine loop to the acoustic illusion of intimate audio.
To the gradual rewriting of public beliefs and the authoring of private desires.
And finally, the terrifying neurobiological permanence of the psychological trap. It is a staggering piece of hidden machinery.
It really is.
We've spent this entire deep dive looking at what happens on a micro level. The individual reader, swiping on her phone during her commute, having her neurochemistry manipulated chapter by chapter.
But we need to look at the macro level.
Yes, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final thought to mull over. Expand this to a macro level. Think about the sheer, unprecedented scale of this industry.
We are talking about millions of books, billions of dollars, entire digital ecosystems built around serialized audio, cliffhanger paywalls, and infinite scrolling.
If an entire generation's private, intrapsychic template for love, intimacy, and arousal is being written from scratch by a commercial algorithm.
An algorithm optimized purely for compulsive consumption, escalating extremes, and endless financial spending.
Exactly. What happens to society when the reality of ordinary, flawed, equal human connection simply cannot generate enough dopamine to keep us interested?
If the blueprint for our deepest desires is drawn by a slot machine,
how do we ever learn to love the messy, unscripted reality of each other? Thank you so much for taking the plunge with us on this complex deep dive. Keep questioning the machinery around you. See you next time.